This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Robert Morley, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine, and today's host for Trumpet Hour, Joel Hilliker, is getting ready to travel, so he asked me to fill in today. I'm happy to be here. We have some, what I think are pretty interesting topics to discuss today. World events are changing very, very quickly these days, and prophecy is being fulfilled at really an unparalleled pace. Here in the studio of the world headquarters of the Philadelphia Church of God and the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus in North Edmond, I have Trumpet staff writer Jeremiah Jocks. Jeremiah, thank you for taking some time out and joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Jeremiah has been part of the Trumpet News Bureau staff for 7 years now. I can't believe time has gone by so quickly. Jeremiah, it's been a pleasure working with you. Jeremiah typically covers events that tend to center around Asia, but he's also over the years been a pretty prolific writer on events centering on Latin America. And that's good today because we have him here in the studio to discuss something that I think has the potential to really greatly impact U.S. security. And it does in some ways center a little bit around Latin America. But before we get to that, you've probably heard President Obama is over in Europe this week. He was over in the UK trying to convince Britain not to leave the European Union. Britain has a vote scheduled in June, and the people of Britain will vote on whether or not to stay in the European Union or to leave the European Union. This is something with huge prophetical implications. This is a topic that Trumpet Daily Radio host Stephen Fleury has been talking a lot about this week. While over in Europe, President Obama told the Brits that he wasn't there to put any pressure on them. And then he pressured them. He said that trade was too often used as a way to coerce nations, and trade pacts were basically used to in negative ways historically, and that nations shouldn't do that. And then he went on to tell Britain that if Britain left the EU, if it chose to leave the EU, it shouldn't expect a trade deal with America for a long time. I think in the president's own words, he said something along the lines of Britain will have to get to the back of the queue or to the back of the line. This is something that I think he might have even mentioned, like, you might have to wait 5 years before we're ready to negotiate a trade pact with you because, you know, UK outside of Europe, you're just a little nation. You're just a little country, and it's not worth our time to negotiate trade deals with just small nations like the UK. And this really stirred up a hornet's nest, especially in the British press over there. The United Kingdom, America's most loyal ally since the end of World War I. And here we have another example, just the latest example in really a string of cases where America has abandoned its traditional allies or has been downgrading relationships with our traditional allies in an effort to win the friendship of our enemies. And this, if you know anything about Bible prophecy, if you've been listening to us for any length of time here, reading the Trumpet magazine, you know this will not work. And we know the future outcome of that. Who really is going to be able to blame the UK for giving up on its relationship with America, as Bible prophecy says it will? But we're going to discuss a little different angle, a slightly different angle to this story today. What happens if the UK does vote to leave the European Union? In particular, what happens to what is left of the remnants of Britain's overseas possession? As you know, Britain at one point had the greatest empire the world has ever seen. When you compare it to, you know, previous empires, the Roman Empire, when you compare it to the Mongolian Empire, the Russian Empire, any of these other empires, when you look at the extent of territory held by the British and just basically how prosperous and how rich the territories were that Britain held, no other nation ever came close to what Britain had at the height of its empire. Well, today, Britain is just a tiny, tiny shell. And President Obama really is right when he said that the UK is just a small nation. It is a second-rate power today in many ways. But the question is, if Britain leaves the EU, what will happen to its overseas possessions, those little bits, those little tiny chunks of empire that remind the world that Britain used to be great. It used to have a world influence in a way that it really doesn't today. And those little tiny pieces of real estate that Britain has really are strategic in some ways. As much as they've lost, they've hung on to, in particular, a couple of pieces of real estate that really are very, very important geopolitically, strategically, militarily, and even economically. So what happens to the Brits who live in places like the Falkland Islands or in Gibraltar? So Jeremiah, I'd like to get your take on this. I know that you have an article with you that caught your attention this week, and that article talks and asks this question. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, well, if you've been following the discussion at all about a British exit, or a Brexit, as it's sometimes cleverly truncated, you know that there are all kinds of arguments on both sides. Why a Brexit would be a bad idea, why it would be a good idea. But a new argument has just been entered into the calculus, and this one has apparently originated from pretty far away from London. The leadership in the Falkland Islands, and also the leadership in Gibraltar, have warned that if Britain leaves the EU, then Britain could lose both territories.
Okay, just let me stop.
The Falklands and Gibraltar.
Let me just stop you here. Maybe you can tell our readers where these places are located for some of them that might not be familiar with the locations of those two territories.
Oh, sure. Yeah, the Falklands is just off maybe a 100 or 200 miles off the coast of southern Argentina, there in the South Atlantic, and then Gibraltar is just off the southern tip of Spain. It's part of a really vital chokehold there that leads into the Mediterranean Sea.
Okay, so two pretty important pieces of real estate.
I think so, especially Gibraltar, in terms of the strategic entry point there to get into the Mediterranean. But basically, the logic behind these claims says that if Britain pulled out of the European Union, then Argentina, which claims to be the rightful owner of the Falklands, and Spain, which claims to be the rightful owner of Gibraltar, they would both take advantage of what might be a militarily weaker and more isolated Britain. And they would ramp up their pressure and their aggression against Britain, and they would try to pry the Falklands and Gibraltar away from Britain.
So the Falklands in particular, this is something that Argentina has tried to gain control of over in the past, haven't they?
Yeah, for decades and decades, it's been ongoing. The Argentines really feel like they own that land. It's so close to their geography, their country. In 1982, I think it was, there was even a pretty bloody war that was waged in which the Argentines tried to basically pry it away. But the British were able to overpower them, though.
Right. Now, the people who live in the Falklands, these are Argentinians or...
They're mostly British ancestry, and they overwhelmingly want to stay aligned with Britain, as does Gibraltar.
Okay, but like as in many cases throughout history, what the people who actually live there want to do sometimes doesn't matter, does it?
It doesn't seem like the Argentine leadership or the Spanish leadership care that much about the desires of the inhabitants of those places.
Of those two places. Right, so what you're saying is that in the past... For at least this is what I'm taking from it. In the past, Britain's been able to defend these territories. But now analysts are wondering if Britain could do it again.
Yeah, that's the essence of it. I've got a statement here from Suki Cameron. She's the Falkland Islands government representative in the United Kingdom. And yesterday she said, a Brexit would have wide-ranging and deep implications. Were the UK no longer a member of the EU, that support would be much less certain from a large number of those EU member states and might encourage Argentina to be much more aggressive in its approach to the Falklands. And then here's a similar statement from a spokesman from the government of Gibraltar. This one I think is even stronger. It says, in Gibraltar's case, experience has shown that Spain would take advantage of any such renegotiation in order to further undermine, isolate, and exclude Gibraltar from the European mainstream. So these leaders in these British outposts are very concerned. They feel like if Britain is no longer a part of the EU, then what's to stop the EU from kind of turning against the British and quickly kind of lending its support to those powers such as Spain, which is, you know, an EU member, and Argentina, which is a cultural cousin to Europe because of its heavy Catholic influence and just a close partner to a lot of European nations. What would stop the EU from suddenly throwing its support behind those nations instead of Britain, if Britain left?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question, because right now, if you look at Europe, with Britain inside of Europe, they basically view, say, the Falklands or Gibraltar there at the southern tip of Spain as part of the EU. I mean, so they're, in that sense, there's no incentive for the EU to recognize, say, Argentina's claim on the Falklands. That doesn't help them at all. It'd be like saying, okay, we're going to recognize a foreign power's claim on territory that we have control over, because Britain is still inside the EU. But if Britain were to leave, that kind of changes that calculus, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It could change it quite a bit. At this juncture, some European leaders may feel like they have, through, you know, vicariously through Britain's leadership in the EU, that they have kind of a de facto control to a degree over those strategic places. And if Britain left, they would feel like that was gone, and they would be inclined, I think, to take some action to reassert some sort of control.
Right. So going forward, you think if that vote goes in June, that Britain decides to leave, I think the polls are pretty close today. It could go either way at this point. President Obama, his efforts to convince the UK to stay seem to have backfired. From what I can tell, I think the polls have moved a percentage or maybe a couple of percent towards the exit. I think a lot of Brits saw his comments as a little bit degrading and a little offensive, and I think it didn't help that cause. But just looking at Gibraltar, let's just talk about Gibraltar for a moment there. That really is one of the world's most strategic pieces of real estate, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a vital sea lane, because anyone who wants to come in or out of the Mediterranean Sea, in many cases, has to basically go through Gibraltar. There's also the port there on the northern tip of Africa, but it's such a narrow entry point and exit point that whoever controls Gibraltar really could assert and control all traffic into that very vital Mediterranean.
Yeah, it is only a couple of miles wide at its narrowest point, isn't it? Just a few miles wide?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how narrow, but it looks skinny on this map anyway.
But the point is, from Gibraltar, whoever controls that port down there has a naval base of operations that basically commands the entrance to the Mediterranean Sea. Like you said, anybody who wants to come in or out of the Mediterranean Sea has to pass by British-held territory. And for hundreds of years, this has given Britain a lot of clout in that region, hasn't it? It was extremely vital during the World War II effort. Historically. So this is something that Britain has really fought hard to keep. And this is something that Spain wants, and you can understand why Spain wants, but because Britain is in the EU, it sounds like, from what you're telling me, the EU has been inclined to say, look, it doesn't help the overall EU to have this bickering between Spain and Britain. And even if we were to side with Spain, it would still, you know, it wouldn't necessarily give the EU any more clout over Gibraltar. So the status quo is fine. Britain leaves the EU, we're upending that whole equation. And now we're in a situation where suddenly the EU might be inclined to take Spain's side over Britain, even though for hundreds of years, and Spain signed away Gibraltar sovereignty in perpetuity forever. So I think just very, very interesting. Before I let you go, Jeremiah, I just want to talk about, there could be other British territories and holdings up for grabs too. I mean, the Falklands, extremely vital piece of infrastructure, really commands the southern route around South America. There's Gibraltar, but there's other little bits of real estate that Britain still holds that could also potentially be up for grabs.
Possibly.
Speculating here.
Yeah. If Britain is perceived as a totally broken power, and as a nation that can't defend any of its claims abroad at all, then we could see even Antarctica, which Britain claims ownership of something like a quarter of, we could see the Chileans and the Argentines decide that they no longer respect those claims because they have conflicting claims on Antarctica. Even in Cyprus, there are still a couple of bases, I believe, that the British hold. We could see the Cypriots or the Turks, as it may be, or even the Russians or the Germans. There's a lot of different claims in Cyprus, but we could see the British influence there quickly erode if those other claimants decided to really push against Britain. And then, yeah, there's a handful of islands all around the Pacific and elsewhere that pretty much anything that, that Britain wouldn't be able to defend, then if they were perceived as too weak to do so, then yeah, we could see a lot of those things being lost.
How about Scotland?
Well, I've read some reports that say if Britain opts out of the EU, Scotland would decide to break away from Great Britain to be an autonomous country so that it could remain in the EU. And perhaps the same could happen with Northern Ireland or Wales. It's tough to say, but those entities would have to choose, in a sense. Do we want to remain part of Great Britain or part of the United Kingdom, or do we want to be part of the European Union? And as Britain continues to weaken, I believe we would see the scales tip more and more often in the direction of the European Union.
I think you just hit a great point when you said, as we see the United Kingdom continue to weaken. Because when you look at it militarily, it really has been on a slide. I mean, that is one of the things driving these concerns about whether or not Gibraltar or the Falklands would remain British possessions, because Britain really doesn't have the military capability to hang on to them in the way that they did in the past. Wouldn't you agree with that?
That's the way I understand it. I think it is important to say that some have said these claims from the leadership in Gibraltar and the Falklands are a little bit alarmist. They've said that they exaggerate the real dangers that would be posed to the Falklands and to Gibraltar by a Brexit. And that's because one of the main military agreements that Britain would rely on in order to defend its overseas territories is a pact between Britain and France. And this pact is not connected to the European Union. So the people who say this is alarmist, they say, look, this pact between Britain and France, it's totally separate from the European Union. Even if Britain left, France would still have its back, and France would still deploy its shared aircraft carrier to help defend British interests. But I think that if you look at this a little bit more long term, I believe that Britain leaving could end up posing a significant threat to that agreement between the British and the French, and just about any other pacts that Britain has with EU member states. Control of the Mediterranean, as you said, is of vital importance to EU leadership. We've seen what a high priority that was during the Second World War. So if modern EU leaders saw Britain leave, I don't think it would be at all outside the realm of possibility for them to pressure France to renege on that agreement so that Europe and Spain could, you know, take control of Gibraltar. And in such a scenario, France would have to choose, basically, as we said with Scotland, whether to remain loyal to Britain or to do the bidding of its European partners.
Right. Very interesting questions. Before I let you go, Jeremiah, one of the reasons we're watching this issue, obviously, is because of Bible prophecy. For our listeners today, perhaps you could just give a little background why we think this is a prophetically important event. Why we watch places like the Falklands and Gibraltar.
Sure. Yeah, we've long been expecting the UK to lose control over the Falklands and Gibraltar. It's part of a really specific set of Bible prophecies that Herbert W. Armstrong often wrote about. He called attention to the fact that the Bible said very clearly that the United States and Britain would come to control every major sea gate in the world. You can look at Genesis 22:17, Genesis 24:60. And then there's also sort of a sister passage there in Deuteronomy 28:52, which says it would lose, the UK and the US would end up losing.
Eventually they would lose it.
Right. And so we've already seen the United States basically lose control of the Panama Canal. We've already seen Britain lose control of the Suez, Singapore, its South African ports, Hong Kong, Malta, Sri Lanka, the Gulf of Guinea, and lots of its influence on Cyprus and several other places. But so far, it has held on to the Falklands and Gibraltar. But now, with a Brexit possibly looming, it just really seems like that could set in motion a chain of events that does strip Britain of some of those last few remaining sea gates and fulfill the last bits of that prophecy there.
Thank you very much. Of course, anybody who wants more information on this can go to the trumpet.com website. If you go to the literature tab up in the top right-hand corner, scroll down and take a look at and look for the book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong. This book has been sent to millions of people. Millions have read this book worldwide. It is a fantastic read. It will open up your Bible. It'll help you understand it in a way that you never have before. So once again, Jeremiah, thank you for taking the time to come in and speak with us today.
Yeah, great to be with you.
And you are writing an article on this. And
That's the hope.
Our listeners can look for that on thetrumpet.com. Okay, time for a break. But before I let our listeners go, if you haven't already, I encourage you to subscribe to the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. This is a current news magazine that covers the economy, science, geopolitics, and our rapidly evolving society. I think our writers do just a fantastic job bringing you the most important news and intelligence. And the best part about this is it's absolutely free, no cost, no obligation. We'll never, ever give your email address away. So if you want to understand the details behind world events, if you want analysis and how they fit into prevailing trends and what it means for you and how that fits into Bible prophecy, then you really do need the Philadelphia Trumpet. So join the close to 300,000 other subscribers by going to thetrumpet.com and clicking on the subscriptions tab. Coming up next, we will be going all the way over to the United Kingdom to discuss recent events in Austria with our European correspondent, Richard Palmer. And then after that, spring is in the air. If you live in the Northern Hemisphere anyway, it's springtime, and that means gardening, planting, farming. So lastly today, we will talk with Herbert W. Armstrong College instructor Steve Herkus about soil, and we will get his thoughts on the global soil crisis and what we can do about it. But first, a break.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Welcome back. This is Robert Morley, contributing editor and today's host for Trumpet Hour. As I mentioned earlier, Joel Hilliker is out today, so he asked me to fill in. We have been talking about Brexit, the fact that Britain will soon vote on whether to leave the EU, and we've talked about some prophetical implications of that. Prophecy is the world lens through which thetrumpet.com and the Trumpet magazine puts context to world events. Thank you for listening in today. As I said, we have a great program for you. Lots of important news to discuss. Still up, we will discuss the global soil crisis and what you can individually do to help preserve and maintain your soil and grow healthful, nutrient-rich food and live a healthier life. But first, before we get to that, we'll go all the way over to Edstone, England. Joining us via Skype is trumpet writer Richard Palmer. Hello, Richard. Thank you for joining us.
No problem. My pleasure.
I have Richard here today to bring us up to speed on some of the latest developments in Europe's migrant crisis. We just saw some pretty dramatic events coming out of Austria. Richard, what happened in Austria?
Well, the top two political parties in Austria, the main left, the main right-wing party, they have supplied Austria's president in every single election going all the way back to 1945. They've really dominated Austria's political scene. And they held a presidential election over the weekend. And these two main parties, they did not come in first and second, as would be expected. They didn't come in second and third. They didn't come in third and fourth, even. These two parties that have dominated Austrian politics for so long, they came in fourth and fifth. So there's a political earthquake in Austria. Last time they held elections, the vote for these two parties combined was 80%. This time it was around 20%. So that in alone is an absolutely colossal story, and that has a lot of people very surprised. But what has gotten people talking even more is that the number one party comes from the Freedom Party of Austria, a right-wing populist fringe party, usually referred to as far-right in our newspaper coverage. And it was a major victory for them. I saw a map that showed which districts they'd come first in. Their color is blue, and just about the entire map of Austria was shaded blue. So this isn't an isolated event or due to some localized support in a few regions. It's a huge shift for Austria, and it's got a lot of people talking within Europe now.
Yeah, talking about this shift, Richard, now this is a party that I don't know if very many Americans would be familiar with, but I think this was the party that was founded, or at least used to be represented by Jörg Haider back in the day.
That's correct, yes.
And tell us a little bit about this party. What sets them apart from the mainstream, the ones that have dominated since the end of World War II?
Well, they are in some ways, they're not mainstream because they're not mainstream. Their heritage doesn't go back to a lot of these mainstream parties, and they say things that are unacceptable to a lot of the mainstream parties. Well, you know what the modern press, modern media is like. If you say anything other than Islam is a religion of peace, you are an Islamophobe. If you have some concerns about migration, then you're racist. So there is a certain amount of that kind of unfair characterization when it comes to the FPO. Their slogan is very much kind of Austria for the Austrians. We need to maintain our heritage, maintain our culture. We need to be suspicious of Muslims. We need to restrict immigration that comes into here. Things that are reasonable, but outside of the mainstream political opinion. However, with the FPO, there are also then some indications that leading members have some more unsavory views. You know, every now and again, you'll get their leader or someone tweet an anti-Semitic cartoon, or they'll make comments about another race that actually is racist rather than just being suspicious of Islam. So I think I'd compare them probably with the National Front in France. They're a party that, if you just look purely at what they say in official statements, it's outside the mainstream, but not really that bad. But then there is this kind of heritage, and some of their longer-standing figures have much more unsavory connections. And then I believe their founders go back to things like the Waffen-SS and kind of quote-unquote reformed Nazis.
I think that is interesting that you mentioning their founding back to the 1940s, how this was even a political earthquake in Austria this week. That saw this election overturn, the first since 1945. You mentioned the National Front, Richard. This sort of thing that we just saw in Austria, the mainstream getting just wiped out, the mainstream struggling to hang on to its typical demographic. That's happening in other states as well, other nations.
That's right, and I think it's very interesting. I mean, when you look at the process that's happening in Austria, you see it everywhere. And I also think it's interesting to look at who came number two in the presidential election, because the candidate that came in second was supported by the Green Party. And we saw exactly the same thing in those dramatic regional election results in Germany. They didn't come in first place, but the party that made the biggest gains was probably the New Alternative for Deutschland party. Again, something on the right, outside of mainstream political opinions. Then the other big gain, though, came from the Green Party. And so what is happening here is the mainstream parties are kind of moving towards the right. Now, they're not far right enough for a lot of people, so they're shifting to the right-wing parties. At the same time, they're too right-wing for a lot of the liberals, and so the liberals are shifting to the much more left-wing parties. And you're left with this, where the mainstream parties are hemorrhaging support to both sides. And it is exactly the same as what you saw in the 1930s with the fascists and the communists kind of rising side by side. Not that the Greens are necessarily communists. They're more socialists disguised as environmentalists. But it's the same trend.
I think it's interesting you just mentioned the 1930s and that history in Europe. Is this what we're seeing again today? Is this something our listeners should really be concerned about? We're seeing a repeat of the conditions that led to, the rise of the dictators in Europe, the Nazis, the National Socialists, et cetera, in the 1930s. Is your contention that we're heading that way again today?
Yes. I think if you look at the history and you look at some of the factors that were around then, they're very similar. You've got the same economic problems. You've got the same high unemployment. You've got the same kind of climate of fear about their future. I think one revealing statistic from Austria, only 12% of Austrians think that their country is moving in the right direction. 52% think that it isn't. So there's a lot of discontent there. Back in the 1930s, you had these brand new parties popping up from nowhere and gaining huge percentages of the vote. And look at Spain has been without a government since, I think it was at the end of last year or beginning of this year, because of brand new parties, Podemos, Ciudadanos, who had come up from nowhere and gain these huge percentages of the vote, then you've also you've got this same kind of dissatisfaction, not just with a specific leader, but this idea that the system is rigged against us. Now, in the 30s, a lot of that manifested itself in anti-Semitism. The system is controlled by Jews who are against us. There's not that same sense in the same degree, at least, anti-Semitism in the same degree at the moment, though it is there to a very worrying extent. But just this sense that the system is broken and therefore we need to look outside of the democratic norms to fix this system. And so people that are willing to vote for a party that didn't exist 6 months ago because they're that desperate for change, they're that concerned about their future. As this crisis drags on, as the unemployment continues to drag on, as governments run out of the ability to borrow money to prop up their social welfare states, then you can very easily see people getting desperate enough to say, look, we've tried all of these political parties. Look at even Greece. They're getting fed up with Syriza, one of the brand new parties. Democracy is not really working for us. We need to try something radically different. And it's just that sense of desperation that is the same, that is similar to the 1930s.
Now, some people say that they take a look at this evidence, everything that you've just said here, and said, well, the political leaders of Europe today have learned their lessons from in the lead up to World War II. They've learned their lessons from the 1930s. And instead of seeing these extremist parties that today are gaining momentum, that's going to be sapped. What we're going to see, they argue, is the mainstream parties start moving more to the poles, start moving further to the left and to the right to take the wind, you know, the wind out of the sail of these radicals. Is that, do you see evidence of that going on, or do you even agree with that statement?
Yes, but we saw that in the 1930s as well. You saw mainstream parties work with the Nazis, for example. And there is, you know, that kind of thing has happened in Austria with the rise of the FPÖ. Other parties have been, the other right-wing party has kind of been forced to work with them where they'd once considered this beyond the pale. So we did see some of that before. The other trend that we're seeing from the 1930s that we're seeing now is this is where the center-left and the center-right kind of unite in a left-right coalition that keeps the to try and keep the extremes out of power. That, I think, was what they tried for the most part in the 1930s, and it created these really unwieldy coalitions and actually ended up sending more support over to the far right. So but I do think you will see maybe more this time of nations shifting to the right. But in that sense, it's not a huge departure from what we saw in the 1930s.
Okay, Richard. So what is this telling us about the future of Europe? What does a Europe that has embraced these views look like?
Well, for starters, it's a lot more unstable. Again, just to kind of focus on the Austria example, with the stunning success of this new party, just like you said, the current leadership is now shifting more to the right wing. They've been doing that over the past few months. But now he's talking about closing down the Brenner Pass, which is Austria's main border pass with Italy. This is a hugely important artery. It's 10 million vehicles use it a year. It's the only road in the region that crosses the Alps. Germany is Italy's main trading partner. And if I remember correctly, most of that trade passes through this Brenner Pass. And so with the rise of the far right, Austria is threatening to shut that down. And so that's going to lead to just a lot more uncertainty, a lot more economic instability, a lot more animosity and arguing between nations. And a lot of these far right parties are very nationalistic. You know, the National Front does not like the EU. The FPÖ does not like the EU. Alternative for Deutschland does not like the EU. So there is the real potential that they get in here and they just make everything much more worse. They make the EU much worse. They mess up everything. When it comes to international cooperation, they make a lot of these crises a lot worse. They just make the whole situation even more desperate. So that's one way that I could see this affecting things. Like I said, the other big thing is it shows that there's a dissatisfaction there with the political system. And so you could see people willing to experiment with constitutional innovations like Hungary, for example, under Viktor Orban, that is kind of morphing more into the authoritarian direction. And a lot of people see Austria and Poland as following suit in that. So you can see a decrease in democracy, perhaps, and people just willing to reach for far more radical solutions and radical people.
Dangerous days in Europe, Richard. Prophetically speaking, what's the next thing we should be looking for out of Europe? Where do you see all of this heading and taking Europe in the future here, in the near future?
Well, and the big prophecy that we point to with a lot of this is the rise of a strong man in Germany. And the same political forces that you see within Austria, you see those going on within Germany. There's a lot of dissatisfaction with Angela Merkel. And so you could see the appetite for somebody who's going to be a lot more firmer, who is willing to break with some of Germany's past, who's willing to be much more involved in getting overseas and solving this migrant crisis. You know, a desperation for someone powerful enough to fix a lot of these problems.
And someone who's going to speak to the concerns of all these people, the people who are voting for these right-wing parties.
Right, who's going to address the problem of immigration rather than pretend that everybody who is against immigration is a racist.
Right. Okay, Richard, thank you very much for that. Look for a strong man coming in Europe. Obviously, anybody who has been listening to the Trumpet radio for a while or has been reading the Trumpet magazine knows these are trends that we have been watching. You can go to if you'd like more information on this, you can go to thetrumpet.com. And to find more information on that, you can read our book, The Holy Roman Empire. Find that on our website. Thank you very much for that report, Richard. Appreciate you coming in today.
Great to be here. Thank you.
This is Trumpet Hour.
Welcome back. This is Robert Morley, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet Magazine and today's host for Trumpet Hour. I'm filling in for Joel Hilliker, who is out. You are listening to 101.3 on the FM dial or kpcg.fm online. We have been talking about Brexit, the fact that Britain will soon vote to decide whether it will stay in the EU or leave, and some of the prophetical implications of that. We have also talked to analyst Richard Palmer in Edstone, England, about really a political earthquake that just struck in Austria for the first time since 1945 and the end of World War II. One of the two main political parties did not win an election. In fact, they were completely decimated, completely wiped out. And we talked about how Europe is beginning to look a lot like the 1930s. But next up, we have another topic. We'll transition now to something very different. We will talk to a man who is a faculty member and an instructor at Herbert W. Armstrong College in Edmond, Oklahoma. Steve Herkus teaches an agriculture class at the college, and today he's going to talk to us about soil. Welcome, Steve.
Great to be here.
Thanks for coming in. I do appreciate that. I'd like to begin our discussion by reading a few paragraphs from an article that caught my attention. This is an article that was published by Time Magazine back in December of 2014, and it's titled, What If the World Runs Out of Soil? What if the world runs out of soil? And this article begins like this. I thought it was a pretty powerful article. It says, it's a strange notion, but some experts fear the world, at its current pace of consumption, is running out of usable topsoil. And this article goes on to say, it says, a rough calculation of the current rates of soil degradation suggests we have about 60 years of topsoil left. Some 40% of soil used for agriculture around the world is classified as either degraded or seriously degraded. 40% of our soil is in trouble, according to this article. This Time article goes on to say that the latter means that 70% of the topsoil, the layer that allows plants to grow, is gone because of various farming methods that strip the soil of carbon and make it less robust, as well as weaker nutrients. Soil is being lost at between 10 and 40 times the rate it can be naturally replenished. And then this article goes on to say that even in well-maintained Europe, we don't think of Europe as the land where there's excessive soil erosion, but they're saying even in Europe, where farming seems ideal, the soil is being lost at unsustainable rates. So this really is a problem facing the world. Yet at the same time, society in general tends to not think a whole lot about soil. I think if you were to talk to the average person on the street, most people don't farm, most people don't garden, they don't have a connection to the land. We just roll up to our local Garden Walmart and we fill up our shopping cart, or we head over to Burger King or McDonald's and get that Big Mac and not realize that what we're eating actually is, in a very real way, connected to the land, connected to soil. So, Steve, we're winding up another year here at Armstrong College, and you teach this agriculture class, Essentials of Agriculture. And I thought you could begin by just discussing some of the content of that course and how it's impacted you and your view on soil.
Sure. Well, soil was a subject that people get very excited about. I get very excited about it. And to be honest, it's a really exciting subject. News articles like you just covered, they pop up from time to time and expose ongoing problems. But those problems really are ongoing all the time and something we always need to be concerned about. And while there are many people who get excited about soil, like you say, there's a lot of people who are oblivious to the problems with soil in our society, but also how awesome and wonderful and exciting soil is as well. And for all of us, it really is our beginning in a way. We know Adam was, you know, made out of the dust of the ground, and our fleshly existence is part of a cycle of regeneration, and we, from the dust we came, and to the dust we return. So soil is something that the soil-man relationship is something that's very intrinsic and important for all of us to consider. And even for those who are not religious, it's pretty hard for them to deny any or to deny a connection between man and dirt. It's just really obvious from what we eat that is grown in the soil, or it's grown on the soil. And, you know, the old adage of we are what we eat runs true, but it's bigger than that, because what we eat is grown in dirt. So it's a subject that we have to be really concerned about and excited about as well.
So this really is a subject that a lot of experts are concerned about. A lot of people who study soil, who make this their living, these influential thinkers and policymakers, they place a lot of importance on soil. I mean, soil has even brought down civilizations in the past.
Yeah, that's correct. It's something that historians, agriculturalists, commentators right throughout history have made a point of showing just how significant it really is. It truly is one of the greatest building blocks of civilization, and the reverse is true, because it can pull down and destroy a civilization as well, like you say. The Roman natural historian and geographer Pliny, he traveled through Morocco. This is around 1st century AD, and just talked about that area, which is now just obviously this desert. But at that time, it was beset by herds of elephants, and there was dense shaded woods and springs gushing up from everywhere. Fruits of all kinds were springing up on their own accord, and there was just it was a luxurious place. And at the same time, though, he was traveling through North Africa, and he noticed forests that were starting to be ransacked by Rome.
Right, and now it's desert today.
Exactly, yeah, we see the results. And so what are we doing today, and what is the result of that going to be in the future? So it is a great source of wealth, not only for us now, but it's a great source of wealth for future generations. And to misuse soil is truly a great crime. A man by the name of Sir Albert Howard, who we quote a lot in the class, he wrote a book called Soil and Health, and this is fairly antiquated English. He wrote this in 1947, but he said, "The using up of soil fertility is as transfer of past capital and of future possibilities to enrich a dishonest present. It is banditry, pure and simple. Moreover, it is a particularly mean form of banditry, because it involves the robbing of future generations which are not here to defend themselves." So we all have to think of soil in this way, that we have a responsibility to look after it for the future generations.
Yeah, so it is, as you said, it is a natural resource. It's something that's there, but it's something that future generations need. And it is one of those things that tends to not get a lot of attention, because we use it and we use it and we use it, and we think it's just always going to be there. But at the same time, as you said, empires, civilizations have fallen because they've robbed the future generations of that soil. They've used it up in unsustainable ways, and that impacted them in the future.
Yeah, exactly. It's more than just a biophysical property. It is a social property. It's something that humankind really depends upon. You can, if you want to think more about the soil-man relationship, it goes beyond just being formed out of the dust of the ground, or, you know, we are what we eat. It comes from the soil. It goes beyond that when we consider just how the human body operates and how soil operates as well. We talk a lot in the class about steps to maintain and improve soil health. And if we think about our physical bodies and what it takes to maintain or to increase our physical health, you know, we obviously need to eat right, we need to move right, we need to exercise correctly. We also need to abstain from, you know, junk foods and junk that could fill our minds to have, you know, true physical health. And when there are people, you know, in this world who, when sickness comes around, when the common cold comes around the office or it comes around the classrooms, there are some people who are just more resistant to sicknesses like that. There are other people who always get sick. Right. And a lot of it gets back to the way we look after our bodies. And what's really fascinating is the soil operates in the same way. If our soil was replete with humus and air and water and micro and macroorganisms, if there's true soil life there, if it's the correct texture, pH, and if it's not being fed a junk food diet of herbicides and pesticides, then it actually becomes a property that is really resistant to disease. It becomes resistant to pests, or at least what's growing on the soil becomes resistant to pests and diseases. And even sudden climatic extremes can be allayed just because the soil will be more robust. So there's a real intrinsic relationship there between soil and man, but also in the way that the human body works and the way soil works. And that was probably one of the, when we went through this part of the class, it was kind of a real interesting nugget that stood out to me. So even because we come from the soil, it shouldn't really surprise us that human health and soil health operate in a very similar way and are very closely linked.
Yeah, this is something that really fascinates me because it sounds to me like you're saying that human health is really linked very closely to soil health. If you want to be healthy, you need to be eating healthy food. But how do you get healthy food? It comes from healthy soils that have all the nutrients and all the micronutrients and all the elements that we need to be healthful ourselves. And I think this is interesting because, you know, we have this whole, in America, we have this whole movement, the organic foods movement, the whole naturally grown movement. People see problems with the food that they're eating. And I think there is a bit of an awareness, a growing awareness in the U.S. and Europe in particular about the need to have healthful food, have food that is healthy for us if we are going to be healthy individuals ourselves.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that awareness is coming about because people were seeing the fruits of a wrong way of doing things.
No pun intended.
Right. It wasn't actually. and they, people, you know, they want answers and they want to know what to do right. And so there is a movement more towards knowing where your food is coming from. And with, you know, the way, you know, things are able to transport, things are able to be transported around, the food from, you know, far away that's grown better is becoming a lot more accessible. Sir Albert Howard, he kind of summed this up. He said, "Disease is the punishment meted out by Mother Earth for adopting methods of agriculture which are not in accordance with nature's law of return. And most of this disease can be traced back to an impoverished soil." So when you look at the population at large and the poor health, sure, it gets down to eating the Big Mac and making some bad choices, not exercising as people should. But a lot of it also goes back even further to the soil that the food is grown in.
So maybe you can just talk a little bit about some of these things that we're doing with our soil that isn't good for our soil. Some of these things that are impacting the soils, these problems that really need to be addressed if we're going to have healthy soils.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really big question. It's not rocket science. Obviously, gardening has its challenges, but you know, everything's very achievable. And for anybody out there who is gardening or has a small farm or just getting started, really, the answer to that question of, you know, what you can do depends upon the situation that you actually have. And so, because we come from the soil, that we each have an individual responsibility to look after the soil that we have, the garden we have, for ourselves, for our own health, but then for that future generation as well. So, you know, the first thing anybody needs to do is just test the soil, find out what the pH is, find out what the texture is, whether it's sandy, loamy, or clay, and then work out what you're going to have to do to fix it. And that's going to be dependent upon your climate in your area, your altitude, what you intend to grow in it. And then you're going to have to form your own plan of attack. Just like if you were correcting the health of your own body, you have to do what you have to do to fix your health problems. Well, your soil, you're going to have to do what you have to do as well. So, you know, obviously adding organic matter is a yep. huge component to increasing or
so
making.
You're big on composting.
Oh, big on compost. But that has to be done right as well. You know, there's a difference between green matter and brown matter, and you have to have the right ratio of each. And so, and that would depend how you would add compost and the way you would make it would depend upon the situation you are beginning with as well. So adding organic matter is a big deal. Cover cropping is just really important. You know, through the winter months, you can sow a crop. You know, that will help. You know, put nitrogen back into the soil, things like that.
Cover the soil.
Yeah, to cover the soil. Erosion, that's right. Prevent erosion. Things, yep. Exactly. Compaction, things like that. You can feed the soil just with cover crops. And the other big thing is crop rotation. It's really easy to just think, look at your veggie garden and think, well, that's the potato patch, and that's where I'm going to plant my potatoes. You know, every single year. Well, how about moving the potatoes to a different part of the veggie garden as you do your succession planting, so that the nutrients that potatoes need are not being pulled all from one patch. They can derive that from different parts of the garden, so you're not eliminating a nutrient from a certain area of your garden. If you rotate your crops through, you can help help sustain your soil in that way. And also, you can keep ahead of the pests as well. Those that like kale, if you keep moving your kale around where it's grown, then you can keep one step ahead of the pest. So it really does get back to, you know, testing it yourself, find out what you need to do, making the adjustments you need to make, and then going back and testing again to make sure those are actually working. And, you know, if you do that right, you're going to see the fruits. But it is important to realize that it is your responsibility, because, you know, you are what you eat. And, you know, if you feed your soil correctly, then it's going to feed you. And, you know, gardening's a big challenge, has its ups and downs. But with that more robust soil that can handle pests, diseases, and, you know, sudden extremes and temperature changes, then gardening is going to be easier if the soil is doing all of that work for you.
Yeah, that gives me some hope there. I know that I haven't been the best green thumb myself, but I love gardening because I know that a lot of the food that we eat today is just nutrient deficient in many ways. And even organic food, you might be able to buy food that doesn't have the pesticides dumped on it, but is that soil that it's that fruit and vegetable is being grown on, is that soil really filled with all those micronutrients that we really need? Is it filled with everything that makes that food taste the way it should? And I've noticed personally, when I garden myself, the food just tastes better than what I buy in the store. So I just love it when spring rolls around each year. I get out there and, you know, we plant our garden and we go to it each year. So you're just getting me really excited about seeing the fruits of that. I have some tomato plants in the ground coming up now. But just looking out the window here from the office, see some rain clouds rolling in. So this is the time of year that people want to be out there preparing their gardens and getting ready to put the seeds in the ground so that they'll have a harvest later on this year that they can really enjoy. And there is a lot of benefits of gardening beyond just eating food, isn't there?
Absolutely. Yeah, getting dirt under your fingernails is it's a wonderful thing, just touching the soil. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of physical benefits to being out in the garden and moving in that way, but also just mentally and emotionally and spiritually. There's so many benefits to derive from gardening. And it really does give us an awesome perspective and helps to maintain that attachment to the soil that we really do have as beings in the flesh. And that's very important for us to remember where we come from. You know, it's interesting that there's humus in soil, and we are humans, and we all need, you know, humility. And I think being in the garden can only help in that way.
Steve, thank you very much for coming into the program. I'm Robert Morley, today's host for Trumpet Hour. I am filling in for Joel Hilliker. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. You can find the stories that we talked about today, as well as many other stories and links to stories, on thetrumpet.com. Send us your thoughts and questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Follow us on Twitter @@thetrumpet_com. Find us on Facebook and Google+. Just search Philadelphia Trumpet. I'll leave you with a quote from Abraham Lincoln. He once said, "The problem with quotes on the internet is that they are often not true." Now, this is exactly why you need thetrumpet.com and you need Trumpet Radio. Each week, we do our best to bring you the truth, to sort the wheat from the chaff. Thank you very much for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Hope you have enjoyed it. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've
been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.